Thank you, Larry. So we'll continue on in our look into the age of the kings and kind of the time frame of the kings. Paul said last week went great looking at Zimri, Omri, and Ahab and kind of the fascinating stories there. And my biggest prayer for Paul last week was to make sure he got through the material so I could just keep going on to the day. So I know sometimes that some things are hang up and things need to be talked about, and it takes longer than we imagine when you're teaching. So we're kinging on, we're looking on, and we're into the divided kingdom, looking at the northern kingdom, Israel, and then the southern kingdom, Judah. And so we got the divide. So we're looking at the kings. So I built this kind of this timeline, this little outline of the kings. So Paul looked here at Elah, Zimri, Omri, and Ahab. But during that time, in the north and the south, we have King Jehoshaphat. And so that's who we're going to look at mainly tonight. It's really just a neat king, a good king, only has maybe a few stumbles along the way. But what he does, and we're going to kind of look at his policies of what he wants his reign to be and how he wants the people to be, are just really firmed and grounded in what God would have and his principles and his law. And so he kind of just takes the reigns of his father, and we look at his father Asa, and we remember him being a good king, a dedicated king, and got rid of all of the junk from his father and the idols and the Asherah. And so he just kind of clears it all. And so Asa is going to pass kind of down those core values to Jehoshaphat here, and we're going to look mainly at him. So just kind of doing a quick review, just kind of maybe kind of catch us up to where we're going at. So we looked originally at Saul, and so his great potential as a young man, good-looking, tall, dark, and handsome, and had just this humility about him, although he had all the perks of one would want for a king or for a young man to look like and be, but he had this great potential, but turned out he was a little psychotic and a little crazy, and makes just really poor choices and goes against what God says. And we know repeatedly over and over again as we look at these kings, if someone doesn't do what God wants, goes on their own way, it usually ends up poorly and usually ends up taking their kingship or even their lives. So then we looked at David, very spiritual king, one who walked in God's eyes, but had his missteps as well, and we all know his sin with Bathsheba and was sinful. And so then we looked at Solomon. It was very affluent, very wise, but he apostated and found his kind of solace in other women towards the end and kind of let that influence overtake him. And then the kingdom is divided. We got Jeroboam and Rehoboam here. And so Judah is going to have the kind of the king of Judah. It's going to have a mix. It's going to be kind of good, kind of bad. But Israel is going to be just all bad. It's going to be all downhill. And I was starting to think about that. Could you imagine having been in the split, but your reputation, if you're Jeroboam, is you have started this trend of just all evil kings. And that's kind of what your lineage is going to be about. And it's just kind of heartbreaking. And so we see that Rehoboam was very foolish. Jeroboam was apostate and did all his thing. Then we kind of have Asa, who we looked at a couple weeks ago. He's very dedicated. Nadab in the north, he was assassinated by Asa, who then takes over as king, and he's adulterous in his 24-year reign. And then Elah, who's assassinated by Zimri. We kind of run on a little run here of assassinations. And then Zimri, who assassinates everybody, he just kind of cleans house and goes through everything. He reigns for 7 days, so he got a whole week, right? And think, man, that's kind of how, if I were ever to become king, I think that's how my reign would go. It'd be 7 days, and people would be sick of it, and we need to move on and get rid of this guy. And so he's burned alive. He's got a really horrible. And then Omri takes over. He's more evil. He builds Samaria. And then Ahab, who's going to be the most evil, and a lot of it due to his very interesting wife, Jezebel, who, if you're called that as a female, it's not exactly the greatest compliment in the world. So Ahab is most evil. He has Baal worship and just kind of has his battles with Elijah, and then how he is kind of brought to end. And Paul mentioned it, and I looked at his notes last week. He mentioned the end of Ahab, and that's where Jehoshaphat kind of crosses over. We'll look a little bit of the crossover a little bit tonight. We won't spend too much time in it and how Ahab dies, but that'll be kind of crossed over. And then we have Jehoshaphat, and he's going to be kind of a good king, one who's stout in God's works. And so there's some interesting things to learn about him, to take and learn from him. And then there's also one little negative thing that we've kind of seen is a running thing. So who is King Jehoshaphat? And it's interesting what his name means, and it's going to be used throughout kind of his reign. Is his name means Yahweh has judged. And so we'll actually kind of see that throughout the stories about his entanglements with the north, his entanglements with his people, and then really his foreign policy, his military policy, his religious policy, and all these different things. And so God has judged, and it's really kind of fascinating. So he's going to take up reign at 35 years old. So I was thinking about this. He's 6 years older than me. So I thought, well, in 6 years, Travis, are you going to be ready to lead God's people? No, maybe not even 60 years I'd be ready for that. And so in 6 years, he's going to take over. So at 35, he's going to reign for 25 years. We've kind of went through this kind of reign where Saul, David, and Solomon have these long tenures, and then we kind of got a little smaller. Now we're kind of threading it back out a little bit. And so Jehoshaphat's going to have 25 years of reign. And what's going to be interesting to note is he's going to walk in the way of his father Asa. And then the thing that we need to pay attention that I want to point out now, we'll look and address this here. He's going to make peace with the north. If you've noticed, and we've looked at it quite extensively, is there's been civil war through almost every kingdom or every king in the north and the south. It's just like, well, my father was at war with the north, so I might as well just pick up that banner and have war and have civil war with the north and the north with the south. And so we just have this constant battling going back and forth, back and forth. So he's going to decide, and maybe he thinks maybe he's going to try to unify again, but he's going to try to make peace with Ahab, and that's actually going to be one of his downfalls, and he's going to have create a marriage alliance through his son, and man, that's going to really be a shot to the foot of himself. And so he's going to make peace, and that's going to be one of those things he's noted for. So let's look into kind of the story of Jehoshaphat and him. So turn over to 2 Chronicles chapter 17. Jehoshaphat's briefly mentioned in 1 Kings. It's really just a handful of verses. And then as you'll know, it says, and then the rest of the story of King Jehoshaphat is mentioned in the book of Chronicles, and is repeated quite a bit. So we'll turn over to 2 Chronicles 17. We'll spend most of our time in the next few chapters of Jehoshaphat, the good, the bad, and the ugly of him and his reign. So we see the fourth king of divided Judah. So start with in verse 1, said, King Jehoshaphat and his son then became king in his place and made his position over Israel firm. And he placed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim, which Asa, his father, had captured. And so we remember that. So we kind of see his military presence is, well, do you remember often, and I don't try to spend a lot of time when we have presidential elections, but you know the debates. The debater, usually the one that's kind of moderating the debate, kind of asks these questions. Well, what's your domestic policy? What's your military policy? What's your religious policy? So you have all these kind of questions, and each candidate has so much time to kind of say, hey, well, what I would do with the military is I would blow away our enemies, or I would try to fortify at home. And so that's what King Jehoshaphat does here. Well, we have all these claimed lands because of my father and through his king. Well, maybe we should fortify those against the north. And so maybe we can create a barrier, a kind of a safe harbor from them, that we can have this huge kind of military. And so he's going to have this military policy of setting garrisons in the cities. And then he's going to have a million-man army. Read over in, you can look at 14 through 19. It has a list of these generals and how many they have. And I didn't really total it, but it gets over a million-man army. So I started thinking about, We don't have any numbers per se of what the other countries or other nations at this time, what their armies looked like. But I thought just for today, I just looked at total of maybe some several countries that have active military. So not active, we have tons more in reserves now, but just the world powers today and their active militaries, China has the most. They have a 2.1 million man army. Now they have more in reserve. They have more, I don't know how they break down each category, but just in active service, 2.1 million. Now even in comparison to their numbers, that's still not a lot, but it's way more than several of those countries. France, I just got a kick out of that, has 202,000. So they're tiny. They rely a lot upon the United States. Canada has 63,000. They're very peaceful. They have 63 active military. So think, well, they'd be easy to take over them. And then Russia has 1 million, so similar. And the United States in active military has 1.3 million. I think with reserves total, we have 1.6, 1.7. So huge militaries now, and the population of the earth is so much more. So even if you were to take and just say you go back on just in the years, in the time frame, a million man army, it's huge. And so he has all the men that he has, and he says, well, what we're going to do is my military policies, I'm going to take care of home and make sure my people are safe, and kind of fulfilling what the people wanted at the beginning, because they wanted a king to be like the others, but to be safe and for them to do the battles and make sure we're not brought into captivity again and again. And so said, hey, we're going to take care of home. So that's my military policy. What's more interesting to know and what's more prevalent is his religious policy. Like his father, he does this really neat thing. So reading with me in verse 3, he said, and the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he followed the example of his father David earlier days and did not seek the Baals, but sought the God of his father, followed his commandments, and did not act as Israel did. So at this time, Ahab is reigning in the north. So God's saying, hey, you're not following that example, not following that kingship, and you're going to do what God has to say. And so he's going to follow God's commandments, and he's going to take great pride in the ways of the Lord and said, hey, this is what was successful for my fathers. This was successful for David. This is what we're going to do. And so for my kingship and my reign, we're going to look to God first. And that's going to be very prevalent in the beginning of his sages. He's going to leave that occasionally, and towards the end, he's going to have one little misstep. But I think with a lot of times, there's a good intention behind it, but just kind of bad execution. And so that's kind of what Jehoshaphat falls short. But he says, and I'm going to even go with my father. Remember, his father tried to remove the high places and all that. Well, you can't really get rid of all false worship in the high places. There are hills and mountains, and you're not going to get everybody. But maybe the more known places, the places that would have had huge altars that they would frequent, he said, oh, we're getting rid of that. No Baal worship, no idol worship here. We're going to follow the one true God, because I've read his law. It's been brought to me. Every king that was put into place was taught the law, so he has some understanding of it and says that's what we're going to follow. So his religious policy is just spot on, and it's just really great. And then kind of his financial policy or his financial strength is because of this, the Lord's going to establish his kingdom. Reading with me in verse 5, and says, so the Lord established the kingdom in his control, and all of Judah brought tribute to Jehoshaphat, and he had great riches and honor. And then in verse 11, and so some of the Philistines brought gifts and silver as a tribute to Jehoshaphat, and other nations are going to bring tribute because they look at this, hey, this guy's got a lot of power, he's got this huge army, maybe we need to sweeten the pot or butter up to him so maybe he doesn't come knocking on our door and he can just continue to focus on the history with him, with the south and the north. And so he has this financial policy and financial strength that comes with it. And then he even has this domestic policy and says, hey, I'm not even just going to keep this stuff for me, but I'm going to teach all of you. And it's just, it's so fascinating. Read with me 7 through 9. I think that's right. In verse 7, then he said, in the third year of his reign, he sent officials, and he names a whole bunch, to teach in the cities of Judah. And then in verse 9, they taught in Judah, having the book of the law of the Lord with them. And they went throughout the cities of Judah and taught among the people and says, we're not just going to leave you uneducated. We're not going to just let you have blind followership of what I'm trying to do here. It says, I'm going to go out and educate you and teach you and show you what God has done and show you the law and how we're going to do these things. I thought, well, how cool is that thing? I'm not just going to take this and, hey, you're going to do what I say. Here, let me show you what I'm doing. There's going to be kind of total transparency for what I'm doing. Paul? No. You're never going to get 100%. Never. Jesus says if everybody likes you, there's something wrong, right? And so it's just fascinating to see his transparency and what he's doing. Yeah, he's not going to get 100% success rate, but he said, hey, it worked for my father. It's worked in the past. That's what we're going to do. That's what my kingship is going to be all about. And so even his domestic policies, I'm going to teach. And he's even going to be, after he's rebuked a little bit later for an error, he says, hey, I'm going to be reformed. And I'm going to even set up judges and a superior court. And we're going to have, and it seems like, although he's the king, it sounds like a democracy kind of, doesn't it? It's kind of set up that way. It's not going to end, but we're kind of heading that way. So it's just fascinating, his policies. And so I thought about that, and I saw this graphic, about a year ago, and I kind of snagged it because I really just liked it. But it said, put God first in your life, and everything else will follow. Rocky and Debbie have been trying to put offer in on a condo or trying to buy a new place, try to get out of an apartment, and they pray, and apparently the answer has been no for 3 or 4 times now. But it's just neat because they're trying to put God first, and those situations probably weren't the right situation. I'm thinking in each one of those houses there was a foundation issue, a plumbing issue, water heater is going to go out, heat pump doesn't. So God's just kind of looking out for them. And I was in that same boat that I got discouraged because of the market and I couldn't find anything, or I kept getting outbid, or someone would drop cash and I had to go through a bank. And it's just, you know, if you put God first, everything else is going to take care of itself. And we see that through Jehoshaphat. He says, well, okay, put God first and everything else. And that's exactly what happens. Look, people are coming to him, bringing him gifts and money and calves and all these great things, and the people are responding. Not all, but they're responding positively. There is peace within the kingdom. So when we truly put God first, man, we don't have to worry about the rest because everything else is just going to follow suit. And so that's kind of the overriding theme, what we kind of see over and over and over again here in the book of Chronicles and Kings, and looking at the kings as soon as you start to move away from God and you start to do just the smallest, slightest little thing. Saul just didn't complete his mission. And God said, I'm done with you. You didn't do what I said, and you tried to do a little bit extra, and you tried to do things that you thought were best for your kingdom, but God says, no, that's not what I told you to do. I told you to get rid of them, to obliterate them, and you didn't because you thought that you could be smarter than me. And so God said, that's not what I want. And so it really is just interesting. It's just the slightest kind of little thing. And so let's get into kind of Jehoshaphat's foreign policy. This is kind of a big deal. I looked at debate logs for the last, I think, 10 elections, this is the number one thing people debate about that they bring up. What is going to be your foreign policy? How are you going to treat allies or maybe someone that doesn't like you as much, the enemies? Well, what's your foreign policy going to be? Are you going to take care about more home, or is your reign going to be more about other places like United Nations, taking care of other countries, ruling other places, and taking care of dictators? So let's look at this, and this is kind of where he makes his little misstep and kind of tries to smooth things over, and it doesn't go over so well for him. So turning over to chapter in 2 Chronicles chapter 18, all these great things are happening, and he's doing well, and so he gets into this thing and said, hey, let's maybe bring unity to the nation and say maybe we can have peace and there's not war and we don't have to lose men and have widows and kids without fathers. And so he says in verse 18 and verse 1, the writer says, now Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, and he allied himself by marriage with Ahab. Now we've seen over and over again, especially with Solomon would go and marry the wife or the daughter. But it's interesting to note the alliance and how it happens here. In verse 2, so some years later, he went down to visit Ahab at Samaria, and Ahab slaughtered many sheep and oxen for him, and people were with him, induced him to go up against Ramoth-Gilead. And so we can see later that he lied himself through marriage, and that marriage is going to be his son. Now, he's going to bless his son with one of the wickedest wives. It goes Jezebel, and then it goes Queen Athaliah. And so he in marriage to Joram, his son, who's going to be next king. And we're going to look at these two next week and their kind of decisions. But just going to be just a total disaster. And we'll look at it more, but her evil, she's a murderer, and then her kind of crazy death. And so he blessed his son with this wicked woman. And you think, well, where did he get this woman from? Who has she learned from? Who were her father and mother? One of the more wicked kings and king's wife. And so her mother is Jezebel. And so he gets in alliance with her and passes it on to his son. And so he doesn't even take it upon himself. And so this is going to be just ends up in a total disaster for it. And so he thought, well, hey, let's get this alliance. Let's have this family. And we're in-laws now. And it's all buddy-buddy. And it's all good. And so Ahab says, okay, now that this has happened, well, how about we use our partnership and go take down some of our enemies and take down some of the nations around us, and we can maybe rule the entire area of Palestine. So he says, well, why don't you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead? And so we can kind of see, so you got the southern kingdom, you got the northern kingdom. Ramoth-Gilead's going to be up here in the north, up here. I got it circled for you. And so said, hey, what? Let's go up there and let's attack, and let's me and you put together. And so Jehoshaphat said, hey, I am as you are. I'm in verse 3. He said, I am as you are, and my people as your people. And the king's reference will say, my horses as your horses, and we will be with you in battle. Said, hey, we are one. We're one body. We're one nation. Let's go and do that. So that has its kind of its own issues, because Ahab says, let's just go and do it. But Jehoshaphat says, well, let's take a minute. Everything I've done before this, I went to God first. I went to his people, to his prophets, and I said, it served me well. Let's do the same here. Let's not get too hasty. Let's just not just go up and do what we want. Let's see what God would have us to do. And so it's kind of that same thing we said, putting God first, everything else will take care of itself. So in 2 Chronicles 18 and verse 4, it said, moreover, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, please inquire first for the word of the Lord. And so he said, hey, let's look to what God has to say. So in verses 5 through 6, then the king of Israel, Ahab, assembled the prophets, 400 men, and said to them, shall we go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I refrain? And they said, go up, for God will give it into the hand of the king. What's the issue with these 400 men? They're not men of God. All of his prophets, and we are going to see with Ahab in the battle on Mount Carmel, that he's going to send false prophets, and they're going to be false And so they're not going to be actual men of God. And so they're going to be liars, and there's going to be a reason for why they're liars, because God's going to intervene, and we'll see that a little bit later. But he's going to ask false prophets, and they're going to say, well, of course, we want to please the king. He's a murderer. He's a terrible king. He walks in evil ways. And if we don't say what he does, he's either going to lock us up or he's going to kill him. So Jehoshaphat's going to kind of maybe see this. And he says, well, how about, do you have a prophet of God? So read in verse 7. It says, and the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, verse 6. And said, but Jehoshaphat said, is there not yet a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him? It says, I'm on to your game, Ahab. I see what you're doing. How about, do you got one that's still kind of faithful to the Lord? So in verse 7, he says, Ahab said to Jehoshaphat, there's yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but always evil. You see that? Thinking, yeah, I got a prophet of the Lord, but you know what his issue is? He doesn't like what I do and what I say, and every time he talks, it's either doom or gloom towards me. So, yeah, I locked him up. I got rid of him. There's no way I want him. And he says, but Jehovah said, let not the king say so. Said, yeah, I got a guy, but I don't want to deal with him because it's always doom and it's always gloom. Well, you're going to have to deal with it anyway. So they're going to bring him up there in verse 12. And send the messenger who sent to summon Micaiah spoke to him saying, behold, the words of the prophets are uniformly favorable to the king. So please let your word be like one of them and speak favorably. This guy, messenger, just said, hey, here's the deal. Go up and lie to him. Just say something nice. Say that you're going to have a good favor. Get on his good side because you're going to be locked up or even worse, killed. And so Micaiah is going to have a smart reply, and I really like this. So in verse 13, but Micaiah said, as the Lord lives, what my God says, that I will speak. So he says, hey, you know what God tells me to do, that's what I'm going to say. So in verse 14, and when he came to the king said to Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead or battle, or shall I refrain? And Micaiah said, go up and succeed, for they have given you unto your hand. Said, hey, you, this is what you want to hear. Go ahead and do it. And so there's some issues with that. So you got to kind of see a smart aleckly response. That's why we say a lot of times on social media, we need like a sarcasm font, right, for some people, because we take things too literally when they see it, and some things are meant in sarcasm and in jest, and some people take it way too seriously. And it's not, it feels like at this point that we need sarcasm font, right? That's what he's trying to say, is hey, whatever you want, go do it. I'm just trying to keep my heir and trying to live a little bit longer. And so we're actually going to see what the true prophecy is. So in verse 17, and then, in verse 15 says, and the king said to him, how many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? So he said, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no masters. Let each one of them return to his house in peace. And then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? Says, I've been through this. We've replayed this over and over and over again. So we see the true policy. And so Micaiah is going to continue on. He said in verse 18, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord standing on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing on his right and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab, king of Israel, to go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said of this while another said that. Then his spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said to him, how? And he said, I will go and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets. And then God said, you are to entice him and also prevail also. Go and do so. Verse 22, now therefore, behold, the Lord has a deceiving spirit in the mouth of these of your prophets, for the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you. So God intervenes and says, hey, that's what I see. This is what I'm seeing. This is the true prophecy. If you go up against here, it's going to be evil. There's going to be No profit for you going up there. And we're going to eventually see, especially for Ahab, because he's going to try to get a little sneaky and try to sneak his way around. And it's going to ultimately be his downfall here. And so the reason why the false prophets are lying and they're saying is because they have a deceiving spirit that's ultimately trying to cause evil for Ahab. And so they're telling him to do the wrong thing while the one prophet, the one man of God, is saying, hey, don't do it, but you think of it as evil because I'm not stroking your ego or telling you what to do. You're doing this. And so the prophet, what if because he spoke evil, is going to be in prison. And Ahab says, I'm going to put you in jail until I safely return and are brought back. And so even for doing that, he's put in to prison. So they head out, and apparently they take no heed into what he says, and they decide to go up to Ramoth-Gilead anyway. And so Ahab's going to disguise himself and kind of put in a plan that says, here's what I'm going to do. So reading with me in verse 28 and 29, says, so the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, went up against Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes. So that the king of Israel disguised himself, and they went into battle. Says, you know what? You kind of stand there. You look like the strong man, the king. People will know what you look like. But I'm going to kind of be the ninja, right? I'm going to be the guy on the side that secretly sneaks up and does war. No one will know that I'm there, and so no one will go after me. Especially in this time, I tried to look at this week while I was doing research, how battle kind of tactics would have been. There's a lot of guesswork, with Rome is as far as we can go back with to say for certain. But they would say that in these types of battle, you would go for the leader first because he'd be the kind of the shining example, the one giving encouragement. As long as he didn't fall, the people would continue to battle. And so in a lot of these times, especially when you get to like this barren land of Megiddo or Engedi, and it's just huge lands, that you, as long as you took out the general or the king or whoever is leading the battle, you would have kind of a one-up on the situation. So Ahab's probably certain aware of this, said, hey, I don't want to be the one that, you know, is taken out, and so I'm going to let Jehoshaphat do that. Well, God says, no, I kind of see through that, and God's going to protect Jehoshaphat. So reading with me in verse 31, and so when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, they said, it is the king of Israel. And they turned aside to fight against him. But Jehoshaphat cried out, and the Lord helped him, and God diverted them from him. First of all, I kind of imagine like the Red Sea parting. And so he's just kind of, people are just diverting, kind of like a semi going. I watched a video of a semi going the wrong way in I-5 somewhere in Northern California. And it's going down the middle of the lane, and cars are just diverting like crazy, because this thing is just barreling into him, and he's trying to swerve out of the way, and you're watching the I-5 traffic cameras, and I mean, just people diverting. So that's what God's kind of maybe doing. It's got, I got my semi, I'm protecting it, and I'm going to have people diverting and shooting their arrows, and they're going to miss, and there's going to be a breath of wind that kind of knocks it out. And so God protects them and diverts the people. Verse 32, and when the captain of the chariot saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. And a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in the joint of the armor. So he said to the driver of the chariot, turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded. Just a random shot. Not so random, looking at it at this point, but from Ahab's standpoint, I'm disguised. No one can know, but especially in a field of battle or in just situation where guns or arrows are placed, it just takes one little mistake or one little error, and it can do just the ultimate damage. And so I tried to look. There's not a lot about armor or where that would have been, but it could have been maybe the side of the neck. They maybe hit an artery or somewhere in the stomach where there might have been literally just a little bit of armor or something that wouldn't have been there. So there was just maybe a joint. And so later in verse 34, in the battle raged that day, and the king of Israel propped himself in the chariot and the Arameans until evening. And at sunset, he died. So Ahab is really coming in. So Paul kind of took care of that last week. So let's kind of look on. And what I started thinking about this was in James chapter 4 and verse 4. James says, "Do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." And I would believe, and kind of my thoughts on it, is that Jehoshaphat is trying to do this alliance, probably with the best of intentions, right? Make peace, bring God's people all together so we're not separated, we're not in civil war. And so let's just have a marriage alliance and let's kind of start the healing process. And God says, well, no, that he's evil and he's wicked. And we tend to maybe have the best of intention, but sometimes just having friendship with the world is hostility towards God. Debbie? Yeah, we're going to see that in the next chapter, why. But yeah, it's still fascinating that this alliance that God's going to clearly not look at, but he still kind of protected him. Let's just jump to that. So in the next verse in chapter 9, and then Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned into safety into the house of Jerusalem. And Jehu the seer went out to meet him. Should you help the, and he said to King Jehoshaphat, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, so bring wrath on yourself from the Lord? But in verse 3, to answer Debbie, he says, but there is some good in you, for you have removed the Asherah from the land, and you have set your heart to seek God. So maybe he had some good clout with God up there in his bank, and God says, I'm just going to maybe take a withdrawal from that and kind of save you. But it's interesting is, even though, I want to phrase this. Because we get into the discussion, because with Saul, Saul didn't do exactly all of what God had entailed, right? And he got punished. His spirit left him. He was replaced with a demon spirit, and he was psychotic, and it was all downhill. And God regretted when he put Saul in there, and it was just for the smallest little thing. But here we see with Jehoshaphat that he does something that God doesn't want him to do, but God gives him a pass. And so it's just kind of interesting where the forgiveness kind of gets in, because you can bring up the question, well, the God of the Old Testament is different than the God of the New Testament, right? You've heard that. We've all heard that. I discussed that with the young people in the high school class. But so where does that kind of bridge start and end? And so Jehu the seer says, through him, says, hey, because there is some good in you, maybe God saw that in Saul there wasn't, and it was just evil, and he was going down the path of that, which we looked quite extensively, there was a difference. And so you removed some of the Baal worship, and you haven't gone down that path that, hey, here's the pass, here's some good clout. And so he kind of slips aside. And so he's going to be kind of lectured through this. And so continuing on in 2 Chronicles in chapter 19 in verse 4. And so Jehoshaphat lived in Jerusalem and went out again from among the people from Beersheba to the hill country of Ephraim and brought them back to the Lord, the God of their fathers, and said, ooh, I learned my lesson. I don't want to have to go through that again, because maybe I've seen what's happened before. And I don't want to disobey God and go the way of what Ahab did and Jehoshaphat's grandfather did. And so I've seen that. So he kind of needs to be reformed from this and said, hey, following Jehu's rebuke, I need to change the way. And so I need to bring the people back to the Lord, which makes me believe that what Paul was mentioning earlier is that you're not getting 100% of the people. So he's gotten this group of teachers out there, maybe it's not being all well received, and so I need to get them back into, and I need to go to the people. Debbie? Yeah. Yes. He liked what he was wearing. They were the same size. He had a Gucci jacket or something, or Men's Warehouse suit, and they wanted to switch it up. But yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Yes.
So I couldn't follow why he did not
we don't know. It doesn't say, but we can maybe, we can make that interpretation. Or maybe the 400 outweighed the one. So maybe doing quick math. Or he just was like Debbie said, he had a trusting heart and said, all right, I want this alliance to work. And so let's go ahead and do this and let's take care of it. And that's where kind of his misstep is. He says he doesn't trust the man of God and went along with it anyways. But that's a great question. So we don't really know. It just says, hey, they went up and did it. So maybe he was prevailing on him. So that's a great question. Debbie? Yeah, that's like when you know which father or mother you can, with certain issue, like if you want to go to, you know, dad's more relaxed on the cookies before dinner. Well, who do you go ask? And mom's like, no cookies before dinner. Who are you going to go ask if you want cookies before dinner? Oh, hey, I'm not going to mom. I'm going to dad and said, hey, he says that I can have cookies. And so I'm going to go with him. And that's kind of where it sets forth my plan. Well, if you look at, let's go back there and let's take a look. It says, and the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you put on your robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and then went about. So it doesn't say that they switched, but it just said they disguised themselves. He disguised himself. Well, we don't know. I can only look into maybe Paul, you have a Holy Spirit to answer that departed on you, but we don't really know. I just go with what the word says here. But you're asking great questions, a lot of that we don't have answers to.
Why they
yeah. That's not. I want you to finish. That's not the question. The question is, did they switch actual attire?
No.
Okay, so that was. Yes. Okay. Okay. Now finish. So that was that's the answer to the question, and then
yeah,
go ahead.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why they aim for military bases. Debbie?
But it says that the other army people thought that Jehoshaphat was the king.
Yeah, just because they maybe saw the armor and...
They saw
something royalty, maybe purple of some sort. So maybe they misspoke. Maybe that was the whole mission, is they wanted to get King Ahab. And so anybody of any kind of... kingly role would have been, hey, that's the target. And then they realized, oh, nah, he doesn't have a beard. He's kind of clean shaven. Let's go look at someone else. So, it could be entirely possible. So the great little things that we can see, kind of seeing the workings of Jehoshaphat's trusting and the seeking nature of Ahab and what kind of brings him down. And so great questions, great discussion. Let's move on and let's maybe kind of catch up. So Jehoshaphat is kind of reformed. He realized, okay, I misstepped. That wasn't a good idea. I've really set up my son for heartache. And he's going to be kind of, we'll look at him next week. He's not going to be an awesome king as well. But he set himself up pretty badly there. So we're going to notice that Jehu is going to be reformed. He's going to go out there. He's going to bring the people back to the Lord. I apologize for those going blurry. That wasn't the point. And then what he's going to do is he's going to set courts and give kind of judicial directives. And so he's going to kind of set up judges along the way. So and kind of maybe a superior court. And he's kind of given them instruction and said, hey, no partiality, no taking bribes, just follow the word of the Lord, judge rightly to the best that you can. We know judges make mistakes, even juries make mistakes. I've seen quite a bit over the last several years, a lot of people coming, their cases coming back, and there's new evidences, and jury didn't have all the things. So they're set free after that. And so we make all these mistakes, but he says, hey, follow God, set up these courts and do what's best. Risa, you had your hand up really quickly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, even when we think about when we first started seeing the people having issues was with Solomon, when two prostitutes bring a baby that they're fighting over. And so he's got to have wisdom and impart that and kind of maneuver his way around that situation. And so a lot of the issues, especially when we notice when the king is not warring and there's peace in that reign, a lot of the issues come from the inside and from the people, and he's always, they're dealing with the domestic policy, and that's what it seems like Jehoshaphat's trying to do, is fixing the people. And that's why I think that phrasing, that he went out to the people and brought them back to the Lord from the idolatry that they've had. And it's interesting because we've had a couple of kings now with Asa and Jehoshaphat, of good kings that tried to do what God had said, and that's kind of their policy of what they wanted to do. And so there's still Baal worship and Asherah worship in the high places, and can't really eliminate sin. I mean, if we could do that, that'd be really clear. There'd be no point. A lot of things would be changed. And so it was just interesting. And so now that the peace of the kingdom is kind of starting to sever, we're going to start to see that Jehoshaphat is going to have to start using that military, that million-man army, because the Ammonites and Moabites are going to come calling, and they're going to war against Jehoshaphat. So in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, let's flip over to chapter 20. And so in verse 2, and then some came and reported to Jehoshaphat, saying, a great multitude is coming against you from beyond the sea, out of Aram. And so in verse 3, Jehoshaphat was afraid and turned his attention to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judea. What was interesting to note, and just kind of a side thing, thinking, he's got this great military, million-man army, and Ahab is just kind of using him before and realizing, man, we could take on the world and take care of all of my side businesses and all these things that I going on. And what is interesting to note, and I think that points to one thing we learned from Jehoshaphat, it was, yeah, he has the capabilities. He believes he has maybe the talents to do this, and he has the army to do it, but he didn't rely on that. So often we see, especially with these kings, rely on advisors or priests or their friends or elders. They didn't rely on them. He didn't rely on his army, but he went and sought God. Said, hey, I may have the power to just get rid of them or whatever the situation may be, but I need to know what God would have me to do. And so that was his injury. Well, yeah, they got all these armies coming at me. I'm afraid. And I need to know where I need to go. Do I trust my generals? Do I trust my fellow people in family, or however it may be? And so a great multitude is coming up from beyond. And so we see Jerusalem up here. So Engedi, where they're coming up from, is down here more towards the sea. It's about 24 miles apart. A lot of commentators will say that's about a one-day forced march. I thought, man, walking 24 miles in one day, that would kind of severely fatigue your army, especially with all the gear and the stuff they're carrying to get there. But you could do it in one day. And so Jehoshaphat's probably aware of this and say, hey, we probably have less than 24 hours or maybe 48 hours at best, 2 days, and they're coming. And so that probably alarms him, and that's probably maybe the extent of why he's so fearful. And so in verse 3, and Jehoshaphat was afraid and turned his attention to seek the Lord, and he proclaimed a fast throughout Judah. And so in verse 4, and they even came from all the cities of Judea to seek the Lord. And so maybe the kind of the tide of the people is changing, realizing if we seek God, we go and follow his statutes, his command, and go to him for advice first, that, hey, everything kind of takes care of itself, and it's been taking care of itself. So maybe Jehoshaphat is kind of working on the people here. And then what Jehoshaphat's going to do with all the people, he's going to give this kind of beautiful, beautiful prayer. Let's read part of that. Let's start in verse 5. And then Jehoshaphat stood in the assembly of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of the Lord before the new court. And he said, O Lord, the God of our fathers, are you not the God in the heavens? Are you not the ruler over all the kingdoms of the nations? Power and might are in your hand so that no one can stand against you. Did you not, O our God, drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it to the descendants of your Abraham, your friend forever? They have lived it and have built your sanctuary there for your name, saying, should evil come upon us, the sword or judgment or pestilence or famine, we will stand before this house and before you, for your name is in this house, and cry to you in our distress, and you will hear us and deliver us. Now behold, the sons of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom you did not Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt. They turned aside from them and did not destroy them. See how they are rewarding us by coming to drive us out from your possession, which you have given us as an inheritance. O our God, will you not judge them? For we are powerless before this great multitude who are coming against us, nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are on you. And verse 13 gave me chills when I read it earlier today. It said, and all Judah was standing before the Lord with their infants and their wives and their children. And they all came together. And so he just gives this kind of this beautiful prayer, recognizing how great God is, what he's done, his promises to the people, to David, to Abraham, to the great things that they've done for him, the sanctuary, the temple they've built, that his name is inside of it. And so this beautiful prayer, and it's what it's going to do is actually lead to their succession in this great battle. And so all of a sudden, the Spirit of the Lord is going to come upon a prophet, and he's going to prophesy, really kind of our last 3 minutes. I want to get through this. We only got a couple of slides. And so Spirit of the Lord is going to come upon a prophet, and he's going to say, hey, don't be afraid. Don't be dismayed. Don't be scared of this multitude that's coming out of us, because the battle, it's not yours, but it's God's. And so we sing that song, the battle belongs to the Lord. And so I went and looked at the history of that song. They don't really say what scripture or what instance kind of is the inspiration of that song. I kind of maybe tend to lean from here, because a lot of the principles in that song and the song and what happens here is in this. But it says, well, the battle belongs to the Lord. Don't worry about it. And so tomorrow you're going to go down against them, and behold, they will come up on the ascent of Ziz, and you will find them at the end of the valley in the front of the wilderness of Jeruel, and God's going to know where they'll be, and he'll take care of you. And it's what's really neat is how he kind of takes care of it. So you will need not to fight in this battle. Station yourselves. Stand and see the salvation of the Lord on your behalf, O Judah and Jerusalem. Do not be feared or dismayed. Tomorrow go out and face them, for the Lord is with you. And so in verse 20, Jehoshaphat's going to give some final instructions. Says, hey, trust God, trust his prophets, and succeed. And you're going to do great things. And so they're going to sing a kind of a beautiful song. It's interesting to note that it's going to mention the attire. The King James Version says the beauty of holiness. And so just this strong sense of confidence. And so what's interesting to note is in verse 22. So let's read that. And it says, and when they began singing and praising the Lord set ambushes against the sons of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, who had come against Judah. So they were routed. For the sons of Ammon and Moab rose against the inhabitants of Mount Seir, destroying them completely. And when they had finished with the inhabitants of Seir, they helped to destroy one another. And so God's going to cause friendly fire. Maybe he confused them. Maybe their arrows just miss, I don't know, you would miss shooting at one place and shoot another, but maybe he directed the arrows a different way. And so God's going to cause friendly fire. The corpses were going to be laying on the ground, so the people are going to wake and they're going to be like, whoa, what happened? And so they're going to see the spoils, they're going to take that, and then God's going to give the kingdom peace once again because of their reliance of him. And so we kind of see, and it's really sad because Jehoshaphat just has a neat story and just a lot of cool things that we can learn in a positive way, because it seems like with all these kings, it's, hey, it's all negative, it's evil. But he does end on a sour note, falling into the same trap he did before. So in 20 and verse 35, he says, "Now the rest of the acts of Jehoshaphat, first to last, world, they are written in the annals of Jehu, which is recorded in the book of Kings of Israel," which is just a little bit. And he said, "After this, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, allied himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel, and he acted wickedly in doing so." Now, we don't know, because later God, the writer, through the Holy Spirit and through God's words, is going to say that he rested with his father Asa, and he's going to be buried in the city of David, and he's going to be one who walked in the sight of God, and he's going to be a good king. So we don't know if this necessarily means his whole kingdom was a sour note. But this is kind of the last thing we have about Jehoshaphat until next chapter in verse 1 is when he lays to rest. And so Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. And Jehoram, his son, became king in his place. And it's going to go bad because of what, really how Jehoram starts out his kingdom with, just a bloodshed to start out. So what's interesting to note in Antiquities by Josephus, on Jehoshaphat's death, he said that he was buried in a magnificent manner, for he had imitated the actions of David. The kingdom was left to Jehoram, who inaugurated the beginning of his reign by causing a massacre. But he was just buried in a very beautiful way. The people really adored this king, and so he was a great king. It was just really sad to see him end on a positive note. So I owe you 2 minutes next week, so we'll end 2 minutes early next week. I appreciate your attention. Jehoshaphat's just a really neat character. I wanted to get through all of it. Next week, we're going to look at Jehoram and his beautiful wife, his evil wife, and the craziness that sets foot. So let's remember those on our prayer list with Karen, with Christy, with Tom,